If you're having questions about how to interact safely with pesticides in your environment, you need to first go look at the label that is on that product. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Working in the Weeds, a podcast from the UF IFAS Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. I'm your host, Jay Farrell, and my co-host, Christine Krebs.
Hello, everybody.
Christine, it's great to be back in the studio. It feels like it's been a long time since we've been here.
Yeah, we have been preparing some recordings for a while now, and now we're getting back into it in the new year.
I didn't even know if I remembered how to get here and how to get everything set up, so I'm glad we're back.
Feels good to be back in the studio, for sure.
All right, so Christine, tell us what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, so at the end of every episode, we encourage a lot of our listeners to submit any questions that they have. We also have a form submission on our website, and there are a lot of in-person engagements that our researchers attend and get some questions from the public about plant management. And so today we have this sort of mailbag style episode again, where we're going to answer some of your common questions. This episode specifically about aquatic herbicide use with invasive plant management.
Yeah, you guys have done a really good job of sending in questions. We want to encourage you to keep sending them in. So we've picked out a few that we think are really interesting and important. So we're just going to go through a few today and see if we can get a little bit more clarity on some of these topics.
Yeah, so you'll see them in the show notes. There's actually a handout guide that you're able to print out or download or distribute digitally with all the questions listed. We're going to highlight five today, about five of them. I'm going to list them right now so that you guys kind of know what to expect throughout the episode. The first one is, will these herbicides harm migratory birds and bees? The second, do herbicides harm fish or affect water quality? The third, are the fish safe to eat after treatments? And on that same note, after a treatment, will these chemicals harm my family or pets when we go and enjoy the water resources? The next one is, why do we continue to spray when there are so few plants? And the final one is, do herbicides contribute to blue-green algae blooms?
Boy, what a great set of questions. So let's start working through these. So let's kind of go back to the top. Will these herbicides harm migratory birds or bees? This is so important because the whole concept behind invasive plant management is to improve the habitat, to encourage and increase biological diversity. If we're out doing things that are harming all these the wildlife that we're trying to encourage, that we're going in the opposite direction. So how do we know that we're doing the right things? Well, this is all part of the huge EPA registration process. So before a pesticide of any kind can be used, it first has to start with the EPA. And there is a 8 to 12 year long process. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars, and they put that molecule through very rigorous studies that sometimes take many years to complete. One entire huge part of this is non-target effects. And when I say it's a huge part, there is an entire division in EPA that is devoted to nothing but this. That group is called BEED, B-E-E-D, the Biological Effects and Evaluation Division. So there is a huge group of highly trained scientists in EPA that they look at biological effects. Yes, we're targeting plants to manage those plants, but what happens to everything else? So they go through and they test this on birds. They test it on insects. They test it on fish. All sorts of creatures that are likely to interact with this pesticide if it's applied in a normal way. If they are finding that the data show that, boy, birds are impacted, well, then we have an issue. Let's take ducks for an example. They're a migratory species. If we are out trying to manage cattail or we're trying to manage water hyacinth and we're impacting the ducks, then we have a huge issue. And EPA will stop everything and say, okay, we've got a problem with bird toxicity. How can we manage around this? So, all right, manufacturer, I'm putting the responsibility back on you. Now, we are not registered yet. This product is not out in the wild yet. They come back to the manufacturer and say, we are starting to see that there's issues with bird toxicity. So are you going to be able to write a label that this material is applied in such a way that you're not going to have any interaction with ducks? Is there a time of year that you can apply when ducks won't be there? Is there an application method that we won't interact with the ducks? And they go through, and then they have to go prove that to EPA. EPA has to then test those mitigations. And if they are able to work around it, then that product may end up on the shelves and out in the wild. If you can't mitigate around these problems, you don't get the registration, that product never comes to market. So there is a very robust multi-year registration process that looks at these things in particular.
And so this rigorous registration process helps prevent any non-target effects on these migratory birds and bees. And we talk a lot or hint at the history behind all this with the Rachel Carson Silent Spring episode that we had. So we'll cite that in our show notes as well in case you all are kind of curious about the history behind it and why science is so accountable now with these herbicides that we use in these wild environments.
And another thing to keep in mind is, let's say EPA misses something. Right? It slips through the cracks. There was an evaluation that they just didn't do. This product goes out into the field, it starts being used, and then we start to observe problems. Those products have to go back through re-registration, and it's usually on a 15-year timeline. But if we start seeing problems with non-target species in the field, that can trigger a re-evaluation at any point.
So every product out in the market is re-registered every 15 years. But if we start seeing issues before the 15-year timeline is up, that product can get asked to be pulled off and looked at again sooner rather than
Absolutely.
Later.
Absolutely. And they will look specifically at these new issues that they're seeing. And again, if there are no mitigations that can be put in place to protect those species, boom, that label has to change and that entire use pattern may go away. So these products are not forever. And if we're seeing a problem, we can always go back, reevaluate, and fix it.
Okay, so this next question, do herbicides harm fish or affect water quality? I think this is a big one that we get very often.
Yes, and it's really important as well, particularly right after we get finished talking about this non-target effect, as we discussed in the first question. People will say, well, all right, then why do I see fish kills? Why do fish kills occur sometimes after an application? You've said the EPA tests this, so what is going on? All right, well, sometimes fish kills can occur, but 99.999% of the time, it is not because of toxicity from the herbicide. The herbicide is not what is killing the fish. What is killing the fish is usually the fact that they die from suffocation. So when you go out into the hot summertime, hot water does not hold as much oxygen as cold water. You have a lot of plants growing on this water. Okay, say it's water hyacinth. We're going out, we're going to manage water hyacinth, and you spray it, it begins to die, and then it starts to decay. As those plants decay, microbes really start to bloom to eat up all of that organic matter and harvest the nutrients in those plants. Well, as those bacteria and fungi are really starting to increase, and I'm talking about a billion-fold increase in the number of these bacteria, they start consuming oxygen as they're breaking that plant down. So it's hot. There's not a lot of oxygen in the water just because of the temperature. Then those decaying plants, the microbes start to suck additional oxygen out, and the fish can actually suffocate because there's no oxygen in the water. So, boy, they sprayed, and now the fish have died. But the fish have died as a secondary effect, not from the herbicide itself. And knowing this, we recommend if you can spray in the cooler months, do your plant management then. If you have to spray in the summer, be very cautious and don't drop out a lot of plants all at once because you can end up with suffocation issues in your fish. And then the second part of this is water quality. And what I think people are usually asking with this is about algae. So we had crystal clear water And then you've gone out and sprayed, and boom, we have all of this algae. So did the herbicides cause the algae? By and large, the answer is no. Okay. So the nutrient loading in Florida water is pretty high just naturally. There's a lot of nutrients in this state. But when you have a lot of plants in that water column, they're going to have critters and all kinds of other things growing on those plants that are also consuming nutrients. So you can have water that looks really, really, really clear when you have hydrilla or something like that, because you're sucking the nutrients out of the water and you're stabilizing that water column, and the little algae cells that will float around in waves, when that water gets really still, they'll start to drop out and they'll settle to the bottom just because they can't stay suspended. Well, you go in and you manage the hydrilla, and boom, you have all this algae. Well, what's going on? Well, you don't have the plants and the periphyton sucking the nutrients down low. We have more mixing of that water now, so the algae is getting resuspended. So it's not that the herbicide is causing the algae as much as it is we have really changed the structure of the water. We've changed the community of that aquatic ecosystem, and the first thing that responds is usually the algae. So how do we prevent this? You prevent it by not allowing acres and acres and acres of invasive plants to be there to begin with. If we can keep the populations low, the system becomes more stable, and then you don't have this oscillating effect of no algae, lots of algae, no algae, lots of algae.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that these lakes are dynamic, they're living systems, and so they're going to react to changes that are happening within the water. And plant management, when it's done proactively, doesn't create these shocks to the system. And I think seeing an herbicide application and then a fish kill following it or an algae bloom following it, it's easy to think cause and direct effect. But it's really this bigger system that is just reacting to all these other variables or components, and plant management tends to be one of those variables. But if it's done proactively and manages smaller amounts of plants over a longer amount of time, there isn't this big shock and concern when things are kind of responding to it.
And something to keep in mind is we can have fish kills when no herbicide has been sprayed, right? If you have, depending on the type of fish it is, if you have big differences in temperature, it gets really cold. If there's tropical type fish that are kind of growing in the North Florida area, boom, they can float because that rapid temperature change can actually kill them. So it's not always because, oh, I saw a herbicide application, now there's a fish kill, or I see a fish kill, there must have been a herbicide application. There's a lot going on out there. But when herbicides are used correctly, used according to the label, and really used smartly by that manager, we are protecting these fish. We are giving them a better environment. We're not disrupting their life cycle.
So I think the answer to this question relates to the answer to the first question, where it's, remember, there's a robust registration process that thinks about these non-target effects and environmental fate, so how long the herbicide lasts in the system. And then also remembering, you know, kind of what we talk about in these lake personality episodes, these lakes are dynamic systems that respond to the environment as well. They're not going to stay the same forever. So since we're on the topic of fish, another question that we often get asked are, do herbicides cause sores on fish?
Yeah, boy, I used to see a lot of comments on different angler groups on social media posing a lot of concern about seeing fish with sores. And they were often saying, boy, I think it's from a herbicide application, because the mindset was there is so much herbicide being used. We're now seeing these fish with sores. It has to be a one-to-one relationship. But I'm not a fish expert, but fortunately, right down the hall from my office is an actual fish veterinarian named Dr. Ruth Francis Floyd. She has some really good publications online, and she's also recorded a very good podcast episode on Cast and Blast Florida that we'll include in the show notes. But Dr. Francis Floyd has said it's not the herbicides that are causing these fish to get sores. It's an infection. So just like people, healthy people have less issues with infections. unhealthy people have more problems with infections. So fish are no different. When they're in a really good, healthy, clean ecosystem with good oxygenated water, good food supply, they're always, just like us, getting nicks and scratches and cuts and bumps, and there'll be a little infection, but then it just goes away. And fish are very good at healing themselves, just like our bodies are. But when you put them in a condition where it's low oxygen because you've got too many floating plants in there and it's preventing that oxygen supply coming in the water. If you've got low quality water that is murky, that they're, again, low dissolved oxygen, they're having a hard time with their diet, they're not feeding properly, they'll get that infection that will persist and really become something that you'll notice when you catch them. So healthy water is healthy fish. And the correlation or the link between herbicides burning fish, it's really not there. What you're seeing is an infection.
Because again, I think it's important to remember that robust registration process and the research that goes behind these herbicides to check for these non-target effects. And fish are on the top of the list when it comes to aquatic herbicides. And there's a lot of things that can stress fish out to bring them more susceptible to infection. And so it's important to keep those things in mind. So we'll link Dr. Francis Floyd's episode with Travis Thompson on Cast and Blast about fish sores, so you guys can listen to learn a little bit more. But that's kind of the boiled down version of the answer to that question. Do herbicides cause sores on fish? All right. So another question, are the fish safe to eat after an herbicide treatment? So how long should someone wait to eat fish after an herbicide treatment? And kind of on that same note, after an herbicide treatment, will these herbicides harm my family or pets? So pets, family, and fish in the water after a treatment, how do you kind of figure out what is safe?
We've all been driving through a neighborhood and we see the little placards in people's front yards that says, hey, True Green or Scott's has been here this afternoon. They've made a herbicide application to this lawn. Stay off the grass, right?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So then we go, okay, we've just seen an applicator go through this lake. Do I have to stay off the water just like I have to stay off the grass? So I see exactly where people are coming from with this question. So how long do you have to wait? And we all know that the little signs in the yard say usually until dry, right? So we know you don't have to stay off forever. We just have to stay off for a little bit of time. But we don't have that kind of guidance a lot of times with aquatic herbicides. So what's the rule? What do we do? Well, this is where the herbicide label is so important. If you're having questions about how to interact safely with pesticides in your environment, you need to first go look at the label that is on that product. It tells you all sorts of things about how it can be used, what are the environmental safety factors that need to be in place, and how to protect yourself, whether you're the applicator or you're just someone in the public. So how long do you have to wait before you harvest fish or eat fish? That it will be on every aquatic herbicide label, and it will give you the amount of time you have to wait between application and then fishing. Because it doesn't say consumption, it just says fishing. Because EPA assumes if you're going to catch a fish, you're probably going to eat it pretty
soon
quickly.
After, yeah.
Right? So it'll just say fishing. By and large, all of the aquatic labels will say there is a 0-day restriction on fishing and swimming. So how long until I can get back into the water? 99% of the time, it's immediate. Because you have to remember that herbicide is being applied and it is immediately diluting in the water column. So 1 acre of water, 3 feet deep, is 1 million gallons of water. So that little bit of herbicide that they're spraying to clean up some water hyacinth or clean up a little patch of water lettuce, that herbicide immediately dilutes, and we know that, and it goes to a level that is you can't even detect very, very, very quickly. But look at the label. And you go, well, how do I know what they've applied? How do I know what label to look at? That's where you need to form a relationship either with the biologist who manages that water or go on FWC's website, What's Happening on My Lake. They will show you in real time what lakes are being treated, what they're being treated with, and it will direct you to where you can go find that information. So it's on the label. You don't have to guess. You don't have to put in fudge factors. It's right there. It's clear in black and white on that label.
Yeah. So for the most part, in most cases, you are safe to enjoy the water body. If you are hesitant and you have witnessed a treatment and you want to know, reaching out to your local management agency in Florida, that is the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and asking, and they'll have that information for you on their website, or usually there's an email or phone number that you can use.
And remember, it's always better to be safe. And if you really feel that you've seen an application and you just it's going to be a problem for you mentally or emotionally to go into that water, well, then stay out of the water until you feel more comfortable. But just realize it doesn't have to be weeks or months. It's often immediate. You can go in. So just give a little time, but it's not a long, long, long process. These pesticides, these herbicides, they start to degrade in the water. Not only do they dilute, they degrade. So the likelihood of them being there at all in just a few weeks is essentially zero.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about aquatic herbicide use and safety with fish, family, pets. A big question that we also get is, do herbicides contribute to blue-green algae blooms? I think we've seen this a lot in the news, and we get this as a question quite often.
So we were just talking about algae a couple of questions ago, but I think it is important to really focus on blue-green algae because this is a nasty little critter that is different from our regular green algaes. Green water can be really good water. That can mean productive, high nutrient, grows big fish, grows all sorts of good things. Blue-green algae can form toxins. So this is one we really need to be aware of and what it is and what is causing the blooms. We keep seeing it in the news, like you just said. What is causing it? And is the herbicide application what is kicking these things off? Because it seems like every summer we start seeing them about the time when we get out and we start seeing those applicator boats. So are these two things connected? Well, a little bit about blue-green algae. So you go back and you talk to limnologists who are specialists who really understand lake development and lake ecosystems, or you talk to a phycologist who's a specialist just on algae, and they'll tell you that go back in the geological record, there have been blue-green algae blooms in Florida for about 10,000 years. So well before any herbicides were ever even thought of. So it is a natural process. So why are we seeing it in the summer? Why are we seeing it when we see those spray boats? Well, blue-green algae blooms happen in the winter. They happen in the summer. They happen almost all the time. Why do they happen when they do? A lot of times we don't know. We do know that if you have too few nutrients, very low amounts of nutrients, it's not likely because you don't have enough nutrients in there to really feed this blue-green algae. When you have more nutrients in the system, they've got plenty of things there to bloom. But most of the water in Florida always has plenty of nutrients for blue-green algae. So it's just sometimes they show up, sometimes they don't. Is it linked to herbicides? Almost always no, because herbicides are not putting new nutrients into the water. And even if they did, there's enough nutrients there to support a bloom anyway. So people will say, well, what about glyphosate? It's got phosphorus in it, and phosphorus feed blooms. Yes, but most of our water has enough phosphorus. The tiny amount you add from glyphosate isn't enough to stimulate a bloom. So why do these things occur? They occur because they're natural. They occur because we have a lot of excess nutrients in our state, a lot of nutrients in our runoff waters. We just have water that is perfect for blue-green algae. Are we going to find a solution anytime in the near future? We're looking. There's a lot of good science being done to figure out how we can predict them, how we can stop them before they really get started. But in the short term, connecting blue-green algae or toxic algae blooms to herbicides, that's really not the connection. There's more environmental factors going on.
And just thinking more in the long term, if herbicides were not used for plant management, then more plants would grow in the system, then there would be a lot more nutrients in the system, and then things would kind of go out of control in a different way.
Right. So we either manage the plants and we deal with the consequences of that, or we don't manage the plants and deal with the consequences of that. And because of flood control, because of mosquito control, we've got to manage these nuisance plants. So we've got to keep this water open. We've got to be able to move the water. We just have to figure out how to handle this pesky, harmful algae in the meantime.
Another thing to consider for homeowners and lakefront property owners is stormwater runoff. And UF IFAS has a really good infographic that they just published about how to, you know, be a responsible homeowner or landowner with stormwater runoff, whether it's washing your car or disposing of pet waste. So I'll link that in the show notes as well. Check it out. There's something we can all do to help our habits not contribute to the environmental consequences. And finally, we've kind of hinted a little bit about how often spray boats are out on the water treating plants. And those that use lakes for recreation can probably share at least one time when they've seen a spray boat out managing plants. So we get the question, why do we continue to spray when there are so few plants? If there isn't a detrimental issue with the plants on the lake in this moment, why are we managing the few invasives that we do see around us?
You know, at risk of kind of sound like a broken record, if there is any topic that we have handled over and over again on this podcast, it is proactive management. There are so many reasons you want to proactively manage plants. The longer you wait and let the problem get larger, now we need more herbicide inputs. We have more damage to the aquatic environment. We have more fluctuations in that ecosystem because of lots of plants, very few plants. The best way to have a healthy aquatic ecosystem is to have a stable ecosystem. And that is to not have this boom and bust of large amounts of plants, small amount of plants. So why do we treat so few? Because if we treat just a few, we can just treat a few. If we wait and let those few go by, those few are going to turn into many. And now we have a much larger thing, that management plan that we have to put in place. Now there's more consequences to that. So I know it is frustrating when people go out and they say, "This, I see this applicator. They literally just went by and sprayed one plant. How can that one plant be of any harm?" Well, that one plant is probably not of any harm. But that one plant can very easily turn into an acre. If it's water hyacinth, one plant can become an acre in 4 to 5 months. So do you want us to manage an acre, or do you want to manage one? And I think it is the environmental solution to manage one plant, keep that population low, keep that water open, keep that water healthy, and then we have a much more stable ecosystem.
So, Dr. Farrell, I'm glad we took the time today to answer some common questions that we received from listeners and other curious stakeholders. Aquatic herbicides are difficult to understand and study, and they're complex. And so these questions are super fair. There are some questions that I've had when I first started my job here. But I think a common theme to some of the answers to each of these questions are that there is a robust registration process for these herbicides. There are labels that come with a lot of information about these herbicides, sometimes more information than you're ever going to need about the product, but it's on the label. It's on the product when you buy the herbicide. And if you have any questions that you can't seem to find the answer to, you're always welcome to email us and we can connect you with the person that does have the answer. The state management agency, especially for the state of Florida, is the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. They have every single piece of information you need about the lakes that are managed in the state. And then finally, it is important to proactively manage these plants so that they don't become a giant problem in these systems. And so staying on top of them, managing them at low levels, is critical and a large part of invasive plant management.
And it's the environmental solution. So I really appreciate these questions coming in. Please keep sending them. These are some of my favorite episodes. I love working through people's questions. So keep them coming, and hopefully we can continue to answer your questions and turn science into solutions.
Thanks, everybody. If you have any questions or ideas for the podcast, please email us at caip@ifas.ufl.edu. That's cape@ifas.ufl.edu. And you can stay connected with us on social media at UF IFAS Cape.